Okay, so first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me a chance to speak at this wonderful workshop. And this talk is based on the following papers written over a couple of the last year and this year. So the outline of my talk is as follows. After a brief introduction and motivation, I will quickly summarize the results for classes of effective four-dimensional supergravity theories, which could arise from certain classes of M-theory and type 2B compactifications. And I'll be very brief on that because Constantine will give you many more details just after me. And I will, the main focus of my talk will be to discuss some phenomenological consequences which basically broadly depend primarily on the moduli stabilization mechanism, which is very similar in those two classes of compactifications. So this would give rise to some qualitatively very similar consequences for some phenomenological observables. And one of those examples, which Gordy already alluded to, was this non-thermal cosmological history. But another such example, which could be this realization of what is known as the string axiverse, and I would explain what I mean by that. And in the course of that, we will see that it could lead to a dynamical solution to the strong CP problem in string theory. And then I will also move on to discussing or making some remarks about more detailed phenomenological consequences, which could, of course, be very different for those two classes of compactifications. And I'll just make some brief remarks, and then I will discuss something about the weak CP problem. Okay, so that's the outline of the talk. So one of the central goals of string phenomenology is to explain values of low energy physics parameters. For example, we know that the fine structure constant is 1 over 137. We have the electron Yukawa, which is 10 to the minus 6. So one of the things which you would like to string phenomenology or any string construction to do is to have some understanding of these values of low energy physics parameters. But from the context of a string compactification, these values of low energy physics parameters are tied to webs of what are known as moduli, which are naively or classically massless. So unless they are fixed, you cannot hope to explain or understand the values of these low energy physics parameters. Of course, so moduli stabilization is of course important to understand the values of low energy physics parameters, but more importantly, it's also important in understanding supersymmetry breaking and its mediation of supersymmetry breaking, and it has very important bearing on cosmological history, early universe cosmology, and observables therein. So it has a very important application to all these aspects of trying to connect string theory to the real world. And needless to say, people have realized the importance of moduli stabilization, and a lot of work has been done in moduli stabilization in many corners. In fact, all corners of string theory, starting from heterotic to type 2A, type 2B, and M theory. And there's just a tremendous amount of literature on this in the literature in the archive and in the papers. And so I just didn't write any of those, write those references. But as you know, many of the experts and the original authors are here in the audience and in the workshop, in the bigger workshop here at KITP. So in this talk, I'll focus on things which I am, which I know a little bit about because I was involved in them. So, and I will tell you about, and in this talk, I will just consider about certain classes of n equals 1 four-dimensional supergravity theories, which could arise in as particular classes of compactifications, from M-theory compactified on 7 manifolds, or type 2B compactifications compactified on 6 manifolds. And I will, for concreteness, I will limit to compactifications with low energy supersymmetry. So I'll very briefly summarize the results for moduli stabilization. If you want to hear more details, you could just wait for Constantine's talk and give rise to many more details. So the basic result is as follows. If what we were able to show is that in the effective four-dimensional supergravity theory, which arises in certain classes of realistic compactifications, which could arise in certain classes of realistic compactifications of M theory, we were able to stabilize all moduli with an entirely non-perturbative superpotential, where there were no fluxes turned on, so the entire superpotential was non-perturbative. And what happened was that there was only one linear combination of the moduli appeared in the superpotential through the gauge kinetic function. And we, even though only one combination appeared in the superpotential, we were able to stabilize all moduli. And we were able to stabilize one combination of axions, but the remaining axions were not stabilized at this level. The remaining axions were massless.
How many moduli did you have? How complete was this compactification?
We did the moduli stabilization at the supergravity level. So we did not consider a concrete compactification. The point was to consider the most general moduli stabilization mechanism which could occur for a large class of compactifications. So a given compactification will supply the topological data or the geometric data to you, and that would be a microscopic parameter. And in terms of those parameters, you're just basically doing a supergravity analysis. So this could arise. This work for arbitrary n moduli. N was a parameter. The number of moduli was a parameter of your, and you could do it for all of them. And the number of Gugino condensates I'm going to talk about, the minimal framework, which works in a phenomenologically viable way, is to have at least two hidden sectors which contribute to the superpotential in a non-perturbative way, which arises from strong gauge dynamics, and at least one of them has to have some charged matter so they have to have some Affleck-Dein-Seiberg-like superpotential with NF less than NC. So what we were able to show that by a discrete choice of ranks or dual Coxeter numbers of gauge groups, it was possible to get low-scale supersymmetry breaking, and you could get spontaneous supersymmetry breaking with metastable de Sitter vacuum. Yes? Okay, so the tuning of the cosmological constant, there's two answers to this question. First of all, here we were only one answer is as far as I can do a bare tuning of the cosmological constant which does not affect the particle physics, then I'm happy with it. That's one answer. If you're interested in particle phenomenology, then I could decouple the question of solving the cosmological constant problem with doing particle physics. And here we were able to show that you can at least coarsely tune the cosmological constant to something near zero. And as long as it is near zero, the values of particle physics parameters, which are relevant for particle physics, don't change. And so, of course, we need another extra mechanism to do the fine tuning to get this 10^-120 electron, 120 times M Planck to the fourth, and that requires some other mechanism, and that we did not discuss in this. But Constantine has another paper in which he discusses this further fine-tuning of 120 orders of magnitude. But that is not relevant for discussing particle physics. Yeah. Huh? This is getting into details of moduli stabilization. I'm happy to discuss this, but that's not the part of the, but anyway. So the point is that we were doing this analysis of this, determining the scalar potential it's a transcendental system of equations. So you cannot solve it completely analytically, but what you can do it is you can do it as an expansion in the 1/1, because if your hidden sector gauge coupling is asymptotically free, the corresponding volume is large, and you can do an expansion in 1/1 volume of that. And we found a solution as an expansion in 1/1 volume. And order by order, you can tune that. You can get your cosmological constant, the final expression for the vacuum energy, and you can tune it order by order. But of course, this is not enough to do the full tuning. It's not a solution of the cosmological constant problem. It's just near zero or close to zero, such that the values of the particle physics parameters are insensitive to that coarse tuning. So as long as I do that, I'm happy to discuss particle physics. I'm not solving the cosmological constant. No. So it's a self-consistent. So you solve for the volume, and then you solve it in terms of your microscopic parameters, and then you make that assumption, make that ansatz, and then your final answer has to be self-consistent. So yeah, we did all this in a self-consistent manner, and Constantine will explain all this. If you're more interested in details, he's going to tell you all about it. So anyway, so yeah,
Yeah. Where is it that all the mudline here is one linear combination?
Well, I don't know about how generic it is. I think it is reasonably generic.
Basically, what you're saying is all the modified blocks are the same.
Yeah, I mean, just saying that the gauge kinetic function is a, and I will talk in the type 2B setup where we have an explicit Calabi-Yau where we're able to do it.
Right. So on the type 2B side, you have this. I'm asking on the M3 side, how generic is it that you have one gauge kinetic function that talks to all the
I think it's reasonably generic, but I don't have a microscopic way of answering your question. I mean.
Okay.
We just assume that it is there as for this analysis. No, I don't know how generic it is. This is just an assumption in our.
We do have calculated them, and we know that there you have different sources, right? That the genome computation cannot turn on all the modules.
But in the M theory case, where everything is geometric, they're on the same basis.
I should get extra time, right? Okay, anyway, so what we realized recently in this paper with Stewart and Constantine and Volker is that this basic idea of this M-theory stabilization mechanism can also be applied to type 2B compactifications, where we have many more explicit examples of Calabi-Yaus. And the basic point is that the complex structure and the dilaton are stabilized in the same way by fluxes at the high scale, but the structure of the superpotential, the dependence of the superpotential in the Kähler moduli is very similar to the dependence of the superpotential on all the moduli in the M-theory case. So you can try to use the same kind of argument and stabilize all Kähler moduli by just a single instanton contribution. And we find a simple condition for that, that if the divisor supporting the instanton is ample with the correct Euler number, then you could do all this by satisfying everything inside the Kähler cone. And Constantine will talk more about that. So that was the main result we got in the type 2B case. The important point which I want to mention here is the phenomenological consequences. And this whole, so as people have asked, that this is not a microscopic construction in which we actually have the full spectrum, the full gauge group, and what the underlying microscopic degrees of freedom are, and then that could be a limitation. But the point of view here which I want to emphasize is that many connections of string theory vacua to observable physics depend primarily on the moduli stabilization mechanism. And in that, if you're interested in those observables, then you really don't need to care about those microscopic data. And one such example is this axiverse, which I'm going to talk about in detail. And since it depends primarily on the moduli stabilization mechanism, it is actually qualitatively very similar, both for type 2B and M-theory compactifications. So this is going to be the topic of discussion now. I'm going to talk about the axiverse. The term axiverse was first coined by Irvani Thakki et al. In this paper. And they discussed the axiverse from a phenomenological point of view. By the axiverse, they just meant a multitude of axions which are roughly distributed evenly on a log scale. And they have this plethora of axions. And so the question is, can you do it, can you realize it more from a string-based point of view? And for concreteness, I'll use the language of M-theory, but all the qualitative results can be completely taken over to the classes of type 2B compactifications, which I considered here, and perhaps to other compactifications which actually have the same qualitative features of the moduli stabilization, which we discussed. So I mean you have these conditions for the divisor, in which the divisor is ample and it kind of intersects positively all the two cycles in your six-dimensional Calabi-Yau, and if it has this for instantons, it has to have this Euler number and all that. So those are the classes of compactifications which I'm considering. Okay, so until now we considered only moduli stabilization, and we found that we stabilized all moduli, but all these axions, barring one, were massless. Now the question is, are these massless axions a problem or a virtue? And it turns out that they are actually a virtue.
Well,
yes.
You have more than one module.
Okay.
My experience is that special algebra that you are looking to do?
No, so there are, of course, there are many, many, many ways of doing it in which you give masses to all the axions. And in fact, I give you examples even in type 2 compact where you give masses to all the axions. I'm saying that that's actually a problem. If you want to solve the strong CP problem, it's actually not a virtue to stabilize. That is the twist in the story, that you actually want to stabilize the moduli, but you don't want to stabilize the axions. So you want to do an asymmetric stabilization. You want to stabilize only the real part and not the imaginary part. And typically, that's not how it happens. Typically, in flux compactifications, you stabilize both the real and the imaginary part of your modulus. And so that's what I'm going to try to explain that. So just to kind of set up the stage, we know how axions occur in string theory. They basically arise as zero modes of the KK reduction of p-form gauge fields. And since in a given realistic compactification, there's supposed to be a lot of moduli and a lot of p-forms, so you expect a number of plethora of axion candidates, and that was the motivation of Arvani Taki et al. To look at the axiverse, but they didn't look at moduli stabilization or axion stabilization or anything. That was their basic motivation. And from a low energy point of view, we know that the Peche-Quinn symmetry or the Peche-Quinn mechanism helps to solve, is probably the most elegant solution to the strong CP problem. It was first discussed by these authors. And also from an observational point of view, it has been known that axions can provide a significant fraction of dark matter. And since they are typically very light, they can have important consequences for astrophysics and cosmology. So axions have good features from low energy physics, and they occur plentiful in string theory. So then it has been a long cherished dream in string phenomenology to use one of these plethora of axions to actually solve the strong CP problem. If you look at Green, Schwarz, and Witten, Witten has a whole section or a whole chapter on this. But just having a plethora of axions in your spectrum does not automatically solve the strong CP problem. You need to satisfy some conditions. And one of the crucial conditions is that solving the strong CP problem requires that the QCD axion dominantly gets a mass from QCD instanton effects, not from any other effects. That means the mass of the QCD axion is given by lambda QCD square over the axion decay constant. And if you have of order gut scale decay constant, that gives you of order 10 to the minus 10 electron volts. So that is one of the crucial requirements of solving the strong CP problem. So now the question is, can we realize this thing in string theory? As Miriam pointed out, this is a non-trivial constraint, which is not satisfied in many cases. In many moduli stabilization mechanisms also give masses to the axions. And for example, in flux compactifications, the fluxes explicitly break the PQ, and the complex structure in Dilaton moduli, the axion partners get a mass order of the string scale. And you would say, okay, what about the axion partners of the Kähler moduli, which are much lighter? But these are also get a mass order of the TeV, because the real part and the imaginary part both get a mass order TeV, which is still much, 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 much larger than MQCD. So these cannot be the axion candidates, the QCD axion candidates. So this is not the only problem. There's another problem with axions in string theory. Typically, you assume that the string scale is larger than the gut scale. That's the typical assumption. And in many models of moduli stabilization, you actually compute the moduli, you can compute the gut scale and the KK scale, and it turns out to be of that order. But then if you assume standard cosmology, you get too many axions. And more precise way of saying it is that if the initial misalignment angle of this axion is order 1, then its relic abundance overcloses the universe. So what are the ways out of this conundrum? You can say, oh, I can make the M string much smaller than the gut scale. That means the volume of the string scale, volume of this extra dimension is very large. But of course, this alpha gut also determines, alpha gut depends on the volume of the visible sector 3 cycle. So that cannot be very large. So I have to make the volume of the visible sector 3 cycle small, I mean sufficiently still in the supergravity regime, but not as large as the volume of the full extra dimension. So you can do that, but that makes M string much smaller than the gut scale, and you lose gauge coupling unification and all that. So that's one thing. The other thing is you can keep M string greater or equal to M gut, but then you have to fine tune your misalignment angle to be much smaller than order 1. And people have also gone this route, and people have looked at anthropics, trying to say why a small theta would be preferred anthropically and all that. In fact, there's also a third option. In fact, you can try to have a different cosmological history before BBN. So all these two results are assuming standard cosmology. So we will see how these three things play out in the framework I'm talking about. So as I said, so a good starting point to solve the strong CP problem is to start with a compactification in which you have asymmetric stabilization, in which you stabilize only the real part but don't stabilize the imaginary part, or vice versa. I mean, it depends on how you define your modulus. So you only stabilize the geometric modulus and not the axion partner. So this was the schematic form of the superpotential. The first two terms were kind of comparable to each other, and they stabilized all the moduli and the one combination of the axions. But then there could be other terms in the superpotential which could stabilize the remaining axions. However, for self-consistency, you require that these other terms must be much smaller than those terms. Because if these terms are of the same order, then they would they would perturb the moduli from the webs which you computed from the first two terms. So for self-consistency of your moduli stabilization, you must require that these are much smaller than those. And one simple way to do that is to assume that the first two terms come from condensates with large ranks, and these other terms come from instantons. If the number of supersymmetric three cycles is large enough, you can probably get enough independent terms. So that is the requirement you have to impose on your superpotential. Yes. I don't think these are those axions. These are just I understand your question. Yeah, in type 2 generally there are these axions which are eaten up and they get a mass.
Yeah, that's an
axion
type 2, right?
Yeah, yeah.
My memory is big, so maybe I'm just wondering.
You get rid. I mean, we. The thing is, we want some of them light, and one of them has to. I mean, and one combination of them could be the QCD axion. So that is what we want. And if there are, so in this particular realization, we have one heavy one, and they have n minus one were light. And you could have three heavy ones or four heavy ones, as long as n is a large number and most of them are light, and that should still work. I mean, in this particular case, just one of them happened to be heavy. So if I just look at more details, the first two terms, the dominant two terms, fix the relative phase between W1 and W2, because the overall phase of W is not an observable quantity. You can just rotate it by a superfield definition. So this phase can be, you can when you look at the potential, you can stabilize this at minus one, and that fixes this less heavy combination of order m3 halves. But these lighter ones, because they are dominant, they are suppressed relative to those two dominant contributions, will be fixed by these cross terms, w1, wk, where k goes from 3 to 4. So these terms will fix the remaining axions at an exponentially suppressed scale. And you can do it more carefully. You can integrate out the heavy moduli, and then you can have a potential for the light axions. What you get is something like that schematically, where these chi1 minus chi k depends on these axion combinations of these light axions. And then you can fix the remaining axions at all at plus minus 1. And it also fixes the relative combination chi k minus chi m, because they can be written like that. So the upshot of all this is that phases in the superpotential dynamically align up to a minus sign. And this is also important for weak CP phases and EDMs, as we will see later. So what is the axion spectrum like? I mean, as it was intuitively clear, because the remaining subdominant terms in the superpotential are exponentially suppressed relative to the first two terms, they will be suppressed relative to the gravitino mass exponentially. And if you do it more carefully, you have this parametric dependence, where FA is of order m gut, and you have this constraint on BK, VK for self-consistency. And then you can find that the axion mass is exponentially suppressed relative to m3 halves. Now, vk in that exponential is actually the volume of the three cycles which you have in your compactification, and they can be stabilized in terms of this hidden sector three cycle with order one coefficients in front. And if you change those order one coefficients in your compactification, you're scanning the compactification, then you will find that these vks differ by order one. And for many axions, n axions will give you an exponential hierarchy in the axion masses, because Vk can differ by order one. So this is exactly what was postulated or assumed in this paper, because this gives rise to an axion spectrum roughly distributed roughly linearly on a log scale. Okay, so what happened? Okay, so until now we have not taken the QCD axion, the QCD instanton effects into account. We just looked at these string instantons which gave rise to non-perturbative contributions to the superpotential and stabilized the axions. So how are we going to solve the strong CP problem? So we know that this, so in this context, the QCD axion is the imaginary part of the visible sector modulus. The modulus which determines the visible sector gauge coupling has an imaginary part, and that is the QCD axion. But you see that this is, and we know that the visible sector 3 cycle is a linear combination of the basis 3 cycles. So in this case, the QCD axion becomes a linear combination of all geometric axions. However, in a supergravity theory, generically the Kähler metric of the axion is non-canonical and non-diagonal. So you have to do a unitary transformation to go to the basis in which the Kähler metric is canonical and diagonal, and that would give rise to some mass eigenstates which are different than the basis, the geometric basis. So when you do these rotations, you will find that theta QCD in general will be a linear combination of all the mass eigenstates. So now these mass eigenstates, as I said, have an exponential hierarchy. So what happens now, so until now I've not taken the QCD effects into account. Now what happens if I take the QCD effects into account? What will happen is that the QCD effects can only change the mass of those eigenstates which are much lighter than this quantity MQCD. Because if there are eigenstates with masses which are heavier than MQCD, then the QCD effects are not strong enough to perturb the webs of those eigenstates. So it can only change the webs of those eigenstates which are much lighter than MQCD. So the upshot of this is that as long as there exists at least one eigenstate with mass less than 10 to the minus 5 times MQCD, which gives rise to 10 to the minus 15 electron volts, then theta QCD is less than 10 to the minus 10, which is the current bound. So you just need one eigenstate in your whole compactification to have a mass which is less than that. And you can check that by choosing order one numbers for your microscopic parameters, which determine the gravitino mass and the various volumes, you can naturally satisfy the above requirement. And interestingly, there's an even more interesting fact that we know that if we want some gauge coupling unification, we know the value of alpha gut, or roughly, has to be around this value. But that in this context means that the volume of one cycle has to be that value. So we know that there must be at least one 3-cycle whose volume is that much from gauge coupling unification. And then you put in the numbers, you automatically get something very close to that number. So you know you have also a kind of empirical evidence that there should be at least one 3-cycle which is sufficiently light. So that, in my sense, gives a solution to the strong CP problem with moduli stabilization. And we actually just put in numbers in an explicit model, and we put in all the numbers, we did it numerically, and all the numerical results agree with all these things which I'm telling you. Okay, so now let's come to the constraints on the axiverse. So it's not just enough to write a model which solves the problem, you have to actually falsify it or confirm it. So for that you need to check all the constraints, cosmological constraints on these spectrum of axions. So as I already said, there is a constraint from the relic abundance, that the axion relic abundance should not overclose the universe, and that's the first constraint. Then there is also constraints from other observables. As you know, axions are very light fields, so there are fluctuations during inflation. Just like any scalar field, just like the inflaton fluctuates during inflation, the axions will also fluctuate during inflation, and these fluctuations get imprinted in cosmology in the form of isocurvature fluctuations. in contrast to adiabatic fluctuations. And because these, they just change the instead of changing delta rho, instead of changing rho, they change the number density n. And then you can compute this quantity alpha a, and there's a bound from WMAP, which is that number. And there's also a bound on tensor modes, which just comes from the fact that it just depends on the Hubble parameter during inflation. And that is also that should also be taken into the mix, because the fluctuations of these axions have a variance which depends on the Hubble parameter as well. So you have to take all these three things together. And now all these bounds, so if you compute these bounds, if you compute these quantities in a given model, you have to actually also know the cosmological history, because you want to know what omega A is, what the relic abundance is, and that depends on the cosmological history. Now, in Arvanitaki et al., they basically considered a very low-scale inflation in which Hubble parameter was almost less than 0.1 GeV, which I think is quite low. And in this case, we wanted to be as model independent and as unbiased as possible, and we look at both cases where the Hubble parameter during inflation was less than this as well as more than this, because the cosmology is qualitatively different. In this case, where this M moduli is of order TeV, right, because that's the mass of the lightest modulus in the compactification, because it's tied to the gravitino mass. So if the Hubble parameter during inflation was less than that, then the moduli are not oscillating, and then you have the standard thermal cosmology. But if the Hubble parameter is bigger, then you have what is known as non-thermal cosmology, and Gordy also talked about this. And presumably this is more generic from a top-down point of view, because a larger Hubble parameter during inflation gives rise to less fine-tuning in explaining slow roll inflation models, if you want to explain epsilon and eta and all those things. So for the thermal cosmology, you have the same parametrics. What I wanted to point out was that for non-thermal cosmology, the computation of the axion relic abundance is modified, and the parametric dependence of the relic abundance on the parameters changes. So in fact, you will see that actually it's independent of the mass of the axions. So this actually helps in significantly reducing the fine-tuning. So here's a plot in which we actually put all these constraints. So plot A is for non-thermal cosmology, and plot B is for standard cosmology. And the x-axis is basically the misalignment angle, and the y-axis is the Hubble parameter during inflation, and everything is on a log scale. So you see that then there's the white region is the allowed region, okay? And then there's bounds from tensor modes, isocurvature, relic abundance. You see that in the non-thermal cosmology, you basically need a percent-level fine-tuning. While in the thermal cosmology, you need almost three orders of magnitude more fine-tuning. So, and this is assuming one axion in each E-folding between 10 to the minus 33 electron volt and 1 electron volt. And this number you just get from the present Hubble parameter. So this is basically a generalization of old results for the entire axiverse in which we put all the constraints. Yeah. No, upper bound, just the upper bound. So if you want less fine-tuning, if you want to be close to this number, then the axion fraction of dark matter has to be order 1. So another important thing is that isocurvature fluctuations can easily distinguish between the two cases. So we don't need theoretical aesthetic logic to distinguish between the two cases. We can just look at data, which could tell us which scenario is preferred. For example, if you look at isocurvature fluctuations here, these are the contour plots of isocurvature fluctuations. The allowed isocurvature fluctuations here are much smaller than the allowed isocurvature fluctuations there. So if you see isocurvature fluctuations in the near future, within this approach, it will rule out thermal cosmology. On the other hand, if you don't see isocurvature fluctuations in the near future, that would strongly favor thermal cosmology over this, at least in this approach, assuming this approach is correct. Yeah?
Your explicit model, did you have this logarithmic sort of distribution?
Yeah. So one axion in each E-folding. So you just distribute them, and you assume that all the misalignment angles are roughly the same, just to reduce the number of parameters, and then you can compute. This is, in type 2B, it should be the same, although quantitatively the results may change, but qualitatively it should be exactly the same, but qualitatively. I have not done the analysis because the numbers might change a little bit, but qualitatively these results should be correct. another important fact is that if you actually observe tensor modes, it will rule out the entire axiverse. This whole picture is ruled out if you observe tensor modes. And that's because you see tensor modes are right up there. Okay? If you actually see, so for example, Planck will probe a couple of orders of magnitude below that, at most one or two. Planck. So if you actually see those, if you actually see tensor modes, these are all ruled out by iso curvature fluctuations in both cosmological histories. So observation of tensor modes will actually rule out this entire axiverse. So this is a falsifiable prediction of this whole scenario. And as I already said, I expect order one fraction of dark matter in the form of axions. And as Gordy was pointing out, for non-thermal cosmology in this M-theory gravity-mediated framework, you expect Vino dark matter. So there's two sources of dark matter.
Could you repeat the statement? Why, if you observe isocurvature in the near future, you rule out thermal cosmology?
Within this approach. So assuming this approach is correct, then you see isocurvature. If you see isocurvature, which is, so you're just below the bound, right? Because the bound is the pink color. The pink color is the bound. So you can be just below the pink color, right? But if you're just below the pink color here, you see, in this case, this is the region below. You have to be, H inflation has to be less than M moduli. So 5 means 10 to the 5 GeV. So you have to be less than that. That means the largest alpha A you can have is 10 to the minus 7. And here is the largest alpha A you can have is 10 to the minus 3. So which is closer to what is being observed? I mean, in the near future, you can go to 10 to the minus 3. Current bound is 10 to the minus 2. So if you go to 10 to the minus 3 and you actually see those, then this can never give rise to that. So that means you've ruled it out in this approach. So that was the statement. Anyway, Arvanitaki et al. Looked at other observables which could help provide evidence for the axiverse. They looked at polarization of the CMB and other things, suppression of matter power spectrum, and then some interesting axion black hole physics, but I'm not going to go into that because they did it. So now I want to change gears and I want to focus on something else. So until now, I was trying to tell you that there are some observables which do not depend on the entire microscopic details of your string vacuum. They only depend on certain features of moduli stabilization mechanism and some things. And so it's important to realize which parts of the data, which aspects of the data are sensitive to which aspects of the theory. And we found that there's this example in which you can look at the axion physics, and that is depends broadly on the features of moduli stabilization. But of course, if you want to go to more details, if you want to look at more detailed phenomenological observables, then you need to understand more, you need to know more information about your microscopic structure. So one thing I just wanted to make some remark on the phenomenology of, and want to compare and contrast between M-theory and type 2B. In M-theory, because we have to compactify on a 7-manifold, and the visible sector and the hidden sector gauge theories live on 3 cycles, and 3 cycles generically do not intersect in 7 dimensions, and you don't expect any warping to be present. So generically, the hidden sector which breaks supersymmetry can only be the supersymmetry breaking can only be transferred to the visible sector by gravity mediation. So it's a very natural assumption and natural expectation. And so that is what you expect in M-theory. In type 2B, the situation is very different, and it's a lot richer. In this thing, the situation is very robust. If I want to be positive about both cases, I would say the situation here is very robust, and the situation here is very rich. The situation here is very, very rich because here you can have warping. Typically, if you have fluxes, you have warping, which you need anyways to stabilize the moduli. And you can also have D brains at singularities giving rise to visible sectors, or you can have D7 brains wrapping 4 cycles. And depending on the location of the visible and hidden sector, you can actually have gravity mediation, which many people have worked on. You can actually have sequestering in gravity mediation, Kutschrew, McAllister, and Sundrum. You can have gauge mediation if you have D brains at singularities, which are close to the warped end of the throat, and many people, including people here, have worked on it. You can have Gaugino mediation, which was talked about yesterday. You can also have Z prime mediation, which I actually forgot to put, and which Paul was talking about. So in type 2B, you can have a host of possibilities, which is much richer. In this case, in the M-theory case, it's much more robust. You only expect gravity mediation. Yes?
Could you
As far as I know, no. We don't have it, or it's not well understood. So now before, I'll just very briefly discuss weak CP phases because in the M-theory case, the gravity mediation is very robust, and so one can try to just look at look at the origin of weak CP phases in this framework by just looking at the gravity-mediated scenarios. And I'll only focus on the flavor diagonal sector. I have nothing to say about flavor off-diagonal sector because that is related to the flavor problem, and that is not well understood in the M-theory case. So I'll only focus on the flavor diagonal sector. And this can actually give rise to electric dipole moments of the neutron, mercury, and thallium and all those things. So if you remember, I told you that the phases in the superpotential dynamically align and in the vacuum. And since the overall phase is not physical, we can treat the superpotential as a real number instead of a complex number. And from the definition of the F terms, because you have these two contributions, W is real. And since W is real, the partial of W is also real. And so we can see that all the FIs are real, and they're aligned with W. And this is a very important point, which is not true. In general, if you have many sources of W which are comparable, then the W's have relative phases. The phases in W do not dynamically align in the vacuum, and the F's have a relative phase between each other and with W. So this gives rise to the supersymmetric CP problem. It can give rise to kind of EDMs, electric dipole moments for the neutron and other things. So if you compute the soft terms, because of the fact that the F term is real, all these contractions, all these are real. So basically, you have negligible CP violating phases from supersymmetric breaking. All the CP violation comes from the Euclideans, which are in the CKM. There's no extra CP violating phases from SUSY breaking. And this is what I already said. But so the question is, have we really gotten rid of all the CP phases? And the answer is actually not quite, because this trilinear term actually has the Yukawas factored out of them. So, and because of this term, because this is the superpotential Yukawa, and it has a non-trivial partial derivative with respect to the superpotential Yukawa. And if this superpotential Yukawa depends on moduli which have non-zero F terms, this will give rise to a misalignment of this trilinears with the Yukawas. So what happens is that even though the reduced trilinear is real, the full trilinear, when you go to the basis in which the Yukawa matrix is flavor diagonal, this introduces order one phases in the full trilinear in the CKM basis. And this actually turns to give rise to contributions to these. And so we can estimate the sizes of contributions in this framework with these parameters, which are large, order greater than 10 TeV or so. And then we have to assume some hierarchical Yukawa texture, because that's the phenomenologically favored Yukawa texture. And then you can compute EDMs using all these machinery, low-scale effective theory, compute all these diagrams, and you find that these are kind of just a few orders of magnitude smaller than the current bounds. But they could be probed in the near future because the parametric dependence, and it's crucial to actually have heavy scalars, because if the scalars were just a factor of 10 lighter, because of the m squared cube, they would actually overproduce these EDMs. So if you want to compare with the type 2b case, if you assume type 2b with gravity mediation, in the type 2b case, actually the trilinears are aligned with the Yukawas, because the superpotential Yukawas only depend on the complex structure moduli, which are typically do not get F-term webs. So there, in that case, you would expect negligible contributions. Anyway, so this is one way to distinguish them. So just to summarize, you've studied particular classes of effective theories which could arise in certain classes of M-theory and type 2b compactifications, and which have interesting features which allow us to connect to observable physics, and without knowing many of the microscopic details of the string construction. And I looked at some of these things. And I think as part of the string vacuum project, it is important to be aware of this fact that not every aspect of the data is related to every aspect of the theory. There are certain aspects of the data data which are related to only broad features of the theory. And so it's important to understand this connection. Of course, if I wanted to understand the full LHC phenomenology, then I need a much more detailed model. I need the full spectrum and the full couplings. But if I want to understand axion physics, then I don't need everything. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say. Thank you. In the case where the complex structure do not break SUSY.
Exactly. Well, yeah. When you turn on anti-brains, then the
don't turn on them.
And in that case, you will induce the F-term for the complex structure moduli. And then you are going to have this problem. So if you use anti-brains for a good thing, then you're going to have this problem.
Why is it that? I mean, it's not a problem. It's just giving you the same thing as
if you have David Taylor, then you can suppress it.
Yeah, that's right.